Good morning. I'm delighted to welcome here with us today Monsignor Héctor Fabio Henao, who is the director of the National Social Pastoral Secretariat of the Colombian Conference of Bishops, and Reverend Mauricio Garcia, who directs the Jesuit Research and Popular Education Center known as CINEP. I believe there's some bios outside, so I'm not going to go into a long list of their accomplishments, but I would just note the book by Mauricio Garcia Duran. That's a new book out called Movimiento por la Paz en Colombia, The Movement for Peace in Colombia, 1978 to 2003, a much needed documentation and analysis of the many efforts within Colombia to secure peace in that country. And I would mention that Monsignor Henao leads the international campaign Peace is Possible in Colombia for the Caritas Internacionales, Confederation of Catholic Social Agencies. Questions of truth and justice are central to various stages of conflicts, to the prevention and resolutions of conflicts, as well as to the reconstruction of social bonds in societies emerging from conflict. This has been an area of tremendous interest to USIP. We've had a working group on memorialization that took place for a number of years, most recently, and has produced a number of publications that are on the table outside. We have produced many special reports on specific truth commissions, on international tribunals. We funded over $3 million worth of grants for projects relating to reconciliation, and these have funded, in turn, films. State of Fear is one that was done on the Peruvian Truth Commission that's won many awards. Another film, Confronting Truth, looking at Truth Commission experiences in different places in the world. We funded education and teaching materials, workshops and conferences, policy reports and monographs, training, and we've given fellowships to a number of people who have examined Truth Commission and transitional justice issues in more depth. And I'll mention here in particular Rosalind Shaw, who looked at the issues regarding the relationship of local reconciliation efforts and national Truth Commission projects, and the work of Pierre Hazan, who is about to put out a book with USIP Press on transitional justice mechanisms, looking at the origins of transitional justice and where the field has come in recent years. In all of these mechanisms for justice and for truth, I think one of the key things that we find is that documentation is really central. And in this respect, documenting the historical truth becomes a really key element for whatever will happen in the next period. Mauricio Garcia Duran and Father Monsignor Henao have both been very involved in various projects of the Catholic Church and the Jesuits to document what's happening on the ground. And this is somewhat unusual, but it's also part of the overall transitional justice need for this documentation, and a need for the documentation to be occurring before the end of the conflict. This brings with it particular risks, and perhaps our two guests can address what some of those risks are and what some of the real challenges they confront in trying to establish a documentary record of what's been going on in Colombia while the conflict is still ongoing. And so with that, I think I'll turn over the podium to Monsignor Henao and ask him to say a few words, and then we'll turn to Father Garcia Duran, and then we'll open it and hopefully have a fair amount of time for discussion. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the invitation today to share with you a little bit the situation in Colombia and our experience in the social pastoral ministry in the Catholic Church at the Bishops' Conference. Last week, on Friday, we had a meeting in Bogota, in Medellin, about reparation, the discussion, the debate today among the different institutions in Colombia working for peace is the issue of reparation, because at the moment the government is in preparation for a new law just to establish the parameters of the reparation in Colombia. And there are several questions about the law, the new law, the process. The process the government had to write the law, and which will be the situation of the victims. I want to stress some of the points just to raise the question of the truth, how to achieve truth in the middle of the conflict, and also to show how difficult it is in Colombia today to have a real definition of the connection between the justice, peace, truth, reconciliation. First, we have a lot of tensions when we speak about justice and truth in Colombia. And the law tried to give the people the opportunity to claim for reparation independently of the truth process. And it's more focused, more focused on other issues, but it's not linked to the truth. I mean, in the future, with this new law, to have access to a reparation, you have to say something. The victim has to say something that he suffered or she suffered during the process. And the government, we suppose, and the tribunals will suppose the goodwill of the people, that they want to say the truth, and they really have been victims, and they will not try to establish connection between this statement and the declaration of the parameters in this case, who have been prosecuted in a trial according to the justice and peace law. So this is the very first big problem. If you don't have a real process of truth in a country like Colombia, you will have a lot of problems for the reconciliation process. The government is trying to have more and more information from the chief of the parameters on jail. They are starting to give information about the atrocities they committed at the time of the confrontations, but it's not clear if they have to say everything or not. It's not clear if that is linked to the reconciliation process. Probably the reconciliation process will take one way, and this other way process will take another way. So two different tracks at the same time. In the middle you have the victims. In the middle you have millions of people trying to know the truth of the atrocities they suffer. But there are not very clear bridges between the both processes. The answer to our government is to say, we will focus reparation in the damages the people suffer, not in the damages the people suffer, but in their rights they were violated. What is the difference? If the government focus the process in the damages the people suffer, they will have to pay, for example, the lands the peasants had before and was stolen by the pyramids, or they have to give the lands to the peasants, or they had to pay, for example, for the people who had been before working in a big city like lawyers or medicians, etc., and they had afterward to go to another city, living in a very very hard conditions in extreme poverty. So they are trying to avoid that. That is the reason. It's not necessary. They are not looking out for the truth. They are looking just for a statement. You say in your statement, there is not the law. The law doesn't say it's not necessary to establish the connection with the declaration of the perpetrators. They just believe you. You are saying the truth, and they will give you something. So the second point is the integrity in the process. So the integrity of justice, truth, peace, reconciliation. We said we can take one or all the different dimensions apart. We have to take all of them together. We have to see the integrity of the process. Now this is a big problem in Colombia. According to the law, you will have the truth in one way and the justice in another way, as I said before. Now, when you speak, for example, about the integrity of reparation, you have a big problem there. Because reparation is not just to have something. The reparation is to have the whole truth for you and for the whole community, for the whole people. This is important. One way is to have the truth for individuals. Is that very helpful for you to understand your situation and to try to rebuild your life? That is very, very important. But that is not enough. That is to give you again your dignity, for example. That is very important, but it's not enough. To give the truth to a whole community, to make public, to give the communities to the opportunity to share and to discuss about the truth given by the perpetrators, for example, by themselves, by the victims, by the witness, and to try to combine all the different versions of the truth, but to give the people the opportunity to reflect on that more, to have some conclusions, is to open the way for the how do you say in English? Not repetition.
So that it would never occur again.
It would never occur again. Yeah. That is the way to achieve that. That is part of the problem. That's the other part of the problem, is to give the truth for the whole community, not just for the individuals, and to show the whole people how to achieve that. The other problem, tension we have, is the tension between different dimensions of the process. You have ethic dimensions, political dimensions, and juridical dimensions. You have three different dimensions when you're looking out for peace, for truth in a process like Colombia, in the middle of the world. In one way, you have ethic problems, ethic demands, ethic questions. That comes from the people, for example. Some people want the whole truth, but at the same time, they want to have justice in terms of jail and punishment for everyone. Or some people say, well, we can negotiate a little bit how much truth do we need at the moment in Colombia, for example. Some people say we don't need the whole truth. The position of the government is that one. We don't need the whole truth. We can negotiate. We can have at least something. This is the first time we have truth in a peace process in Colombia. Well, we can have to try to have the most as possible, but not everything. This is first of all an ethic problem. This is part of the ethic dimension. What means truth in a peace process? And how cheap truth? Truth is to know just the atrocities you committed. Truth is to know the connection you have before with other people on the power, for example, the people giving the orders. That is part of the truth. Part of the truth is also to say if you committed some atrocities because there were big economical projects in the region, for example. That's part or not. Or just to say the massacres you committed. This part, one part of the problem. The other part is, the other dimension is the political dimension. You have many, many questions around. Is the decision of a government, the decision of a society, to say how and until what point you could have the truth in the society. Is to say, to take the decision, for example, if you want to listen to the witness or not, if you want to give the opportunity to the victims to be in the trades, to be present there, and to discuss with the perpetrators or not. Or you will give the opportunity to the people just to follow up on television. That is one of the problems, for example, today in Colombia. How the people follow the declaration of the people in jail. They follow by television. They will have versions of the lawyers, what they will have. And also the decision of the government to say, well, what we will do with that truth? We will give, for example, symbolic reparations. We will make a monument for the victims. We will do something in terms of the communities to give them at least the names of the people who suffer or not. Or instead of that, we will, for example, give to the children at the schools, for example, lessons about the histories of the victims. That could be interesting. The children at the school, for example, they could listen the version of the victims and the version of the perpetrators. That is a political decision. Some people in Colombia say it could be very, very important for the children at the school to listen different versions and to know a little bit more about the atrocities committed. Other ones say, no, that could traumatize our children. It's better to say nothing. To try to hide the sum with the heart. That's the other problem. And you have more political problems. You have people in power who said, well, if we have the truth, that could be dangerous also for the systems, because many people have been involved on that. And the last one is the juridical dimension. The juridical dimension is very important, in my opinion, because the judge, they have to say very clear which is the consequence when you say the truth to the people. Many people in Colombia think that South Africa is the best example. You know, in South Africa, there were some trials, the people, they said the truth, the atrocities they committed, and afterward, probably they had an amnesty or something like that. Many people in Colombia think this is a very good idea. Others say, be careful, it's a good way, but it's not the best one. There is not a best way in this case. Each country is different. Each country is different. Myself, I went once to South Africa. By coincidence, I arrived at the moment in one man was he made his declarations because he put the bomb to a bishop conference in South Africa, Catholic bishop conference in South Africa. That was a very big coincidence. I went that day just to say something. And I arrived at the moment when he started to declare the declaration. It was amazing for me because he said the atrocities, that was great. The victim was there. But when the people there in the table, they asked to him, you receive any request from someone in the power to put the bomb at the Catholic Bishop Conference? He said, I don't remember. You share with someone. That was some years ago. I don't remember if I shared with someone. Why you was transferred immediately to another city? No, I don't know. I don't know. Who knows? For myself, it's impossible to know. So he remembered just some particular issues, but not the whole situation. Was impossible to go up in the chain of the orders he received. Apparently, he took the decision himself, but was impossible. He didn't share that with anybody. He just forgot who received the order to go to put really the bomb. That is the problem, for example, when you look on South Africa. Colombia could be a big problem in that case also. You can, when you go, for example, today, make an evaluation of the trials, that we take more than 100 years to listen to the voice of the parameters. That's going very, very slowly. They speak very, very slowly. They got a lot of difficulties to remember. Some of them, they are very ill. They have very difficult problems with their health because they are old people, difficult to remember. Some of them, they lose the memory in general. In particular, the memory of that time. They remember their childhood and the today no more. So that's quite difficult. That's the challenges. But for me, today in Colombia, the main challenge is the integrity. When you speak about peace, justice, truth, is to understand that it's one thing, not two different tracks and three different rights, but you must see the integrity of the rights in the case of the victims. It's the only way to go forward and to try to solve the situation. Just to be sure that will not happen in the future the same atrocities we had in the past. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good morning for everybody. I am not going to repeat what Monsignor Hector Fabio said. I want to focus in two main points. One is, how does polarization of society affect the searching for truth in Colombia? Because this is something that I feel we are living in this moment. And the other question is connected with this, how to find the truth while the conflict has not finished? Is the problem is if it's possible to search for truth in this moment of the conflict. Starting with the first point, I feel we need to look to two main situations, two massive mobilization we had in recently. One was a huge march on the February the 4th, and the other was another less massive march, but also important march in March the 6th. These two marches, for me, show what are the situation in Colombia in connection with the searching for truth. The first one was a call in order to protest against FARC. This one, the main focus. Nevertheless, many people marched with other purposes. And many people, including our institution, we say, well, yeah, we don't agree with the things that FARC has done. But we also think that there are other atrocities that we need to have in mind. From the paramilitary groups and also from the army, from the official forces. And also, the same happened in the other march. And I feel there was, in some way, a consensus among different organizations that nowadays in Colombia, you need to reject all the forms of violence. Doesn't matter who is the perpetrator. And you can find several situations connected with the paramilitary groups, with the army, but also with the guerrilla groups. And it's important to be aware of this. And something that is interesting to know is, in this situation of polarization, the problem is that some people is focusing in one truth, and other people is focusing in another truth. And the challenge for me is how we can find the way to put both truths together. Because at the end of the day, are connected, are the part of the whole story. You know, in the last 30 years, at least 90,000 people had died in connection with the armed conflict. Both people who died in combat and political assassinations, massacres, and so on. It's 90,000 people. Near 40,000 people has been kidnapped in these years, in the last 30 years. And between 3 and 4 million people have been displaced. You have, this is the reality of the truth. And now we start with the peace and justice law. Something that has been interesting with this law is that despite that there are no enough guarantees to find all the truth and to really punish and to overcome impunity, we have discovered a lot of things with the declaration of the paramilitary groups. Some of the paramilitary leaders have told us something horrible that they have done in the past years. We know that there are at least 4,000 mass graves where people who disappeared and was killed is and we start to know this. But I feel that we need to be aware of these two sides of the story. Now, given the situation with the kidnapped people, all the focus, many attention in the news, in the press, in the political space, is given to the people and the atrocities of the guerrilla. And obviously, it seems that the problem is only the guerrilla groups. I feel, yeah, it's part of the problem. But we can't forget that in the last 30 years, 75% of the massacres and people that were killed was responsibility of the paramilitary groups. More or less, the percentage is 75% of the paramilitary groups, 20% of the guerrilla groups, and depending on the year, between 5 and 10% of the official armed forces. And this is the picture in general. And it's important to be aware of this complexity, how to know that these are connected, because sometimes the problem, or part of the argument, is that given that people, that there are these people kidnapped, it's possible to do other things, because it's a legitimate response to this threat that we are facing with the guerrilla groups. But on the other hand, you find this situation in the conflict. Let me show what happened with the international humanitarian law violations by the armed actors. And you can see this. The yellow one is the paramilitary groups. The orange one is FARC, and the blue one is the armed forces. Look what is happening in this moment. And this is very serious in our point of view, because this is all what has been called falsos positivos, false positives, is extrajudicial executions. And this is growing. And probably things can change, but the problem is when the responsibility of the paramilitary groups go down, look what happened with the responsibility of the this is one point. For me, this is something that we need to have in mind in connection with the second point that I want to call your attention. This is certainly, there is an armed conflict in Colombia. And this conflict is still going on. It's not something that has finished. The government has claimed that the conflict is finished, that there is no more armed conflict, that what we have is a terrorist threat, that this is the problem. But we think that the situation is more complex. Obviously, the level of the conflict has descended compared with the level of 2000-2001, but we remain in a similar level to the one the country had in the 90s, when, according to international standards, the armed conflict in Colombia reached the level of major armed conflict or internal civil war. In 2006, there were similar levels of armed activity, violations to the international humanitarian law, and municipalities affected by the conflict. Some regions had been heavily affected, as is the case of the Pacific Coast. The situation, and we know this for the church, the situation of all the dioceses in the Pacific Coast has been really, really difficult, and they have faced a very complex situation and violations of human rights in that region. But a second point is there are serious questions about the demobilization and dismantling of the paramilitary groups. And this is something that, for me, is quite critical. In other words, in all the regions, either we are working or we have strong links with local organizations, it is clear that the paramilitaries remain active. Sometimes I have visited some regions and people say, "Father, they are there. They are the same groups. Maybe with a different name, maybe with a different way of operating, but they say they are the same structure. They are the same people and with the same bosses." And this is something that for us is really critical. The official report of the National Commission of Reparation and Reconciliation confirmed that by August 2007, there were between 3,000 and 5,000 paramilitaries active. In the past, speak about 9,000. I feel that this is something that this is a map from the commission, the National Commission for Reparation and Reconciliation, and you can see all these points that in the map is places where there are still paramilitary groups, and you can see it has a national coverage. It's not something located in one region or other, but it's something that has a national impact. The third point in connection with this is one of the points of concern from the human rights organizations is the growing responsibility of the militaries, particularly the army, in the trend of violation of human rights and international humanitarian law. As a clear example of this, we found between July 2006 and June 2007, 90 cases of extrajudicial execution and other abuses which were presented by the armed forces as a positive resource against the guerrilla groups, when in fact they were human rights abuses. And this is one of the cases is with maybe you have here with the peace community of San José de Apartado. And last week, the judicial system called to more than 10 of these militaries to be in court, given this problem. But it's clear that it was not a problem of the guerrilla, that the government claimed in a moment that say this was the guerrilla that did this, had no problem of the paramilitaries, but was directly from the army. And now the case is in the court. But also, I think it's important to be aware with some of the abuses committed by the guerrilla groups, particularly by FARC. And I think it's important to have in mind 3 points. One is the guerrillas' landmine use takes heavy toll in civilians, as the report of Human Rights Watch showed early last year. So this is a real case. Secondly, there was important level of violence during the electoral process in October last year. 29 candidates were killed and 9 kidnapped. At least 4 of them were killed by FARC, and 17 were threatened by them. And this was another point in which there was a presence of the guerrilla, but also of the paramilitary groups in the electoral process. And in third point, some social organizations have been affected by FARC's actions, which affected the autonomy of this social and ethnic organization. This is the case of COCOMASIA, that is an organization of the communal organization in the Atrato, in the Chocó, which has recently denounced the kidnapping of several community leaders, but also the killing of others between 2001 and 2003. To find the truth in this context is not easy. And I feel the challenge for us and the challenge for the international community and the humanitarian groups and the human rights groups in the country and abroad is to pay attention to the complexity of this situation and to look that we are facing a conflict in which all the parts has responsibility in human rights. And my call to say something is we need to be aware of this and not to focus only one part of the problem, but try to have the whole picture of the human rights violations in Colombia. Thank you.
Many thanks. Perhaps we can continue the conversation from the table with the audience, and I'll start off launching a couple of questions, and then I would ask if you have questions that you might go to the microphone on the side and line up from there. I want to thank you both for very provocative and thoughtful presentations, and ask Monsignor Henao perhaps to start off talking a bit about the work of the church with victims, in particular the efforts to document the Tevere, the route, and maybe other initiatives that you're aware of that you've been involved with on the ground. And Mauricio, I wonder if you could talk about the relationship between repression and civil society efforts to mobilize for peace, because I think this has been a really key theme. I'm thinking in particular about some of the organizers of the March 6th demonstrations and marches and the difficulties that they're having in trying to bring truth into the public realm.
In the 80s and 90s, almost no one in Colombia recognized the situation of the internally displaced people. There were a lot of internally displaced people at that moment, but the name internally displaced people and the situation that was not recognized by the law or by the society in general. So the Bishop Conference took the decision at the beginning of the 90s to have a report on the situation of the internally displaced people in the country. And we divided the country in different regions and zones to have information about that. And we started a database on the IDPs. That database made the first national report in Colombia about this situation, and we made visible this tragedy. From that, we continue to work with our database, more focused on particular situations, not on the whole statistics, because the other institutions like others, for example, and afterward the national government, they took the decision to have a database on the statistics, on the numbers. So afterward we changed our profile and we decided to continue ahead with the database, but more focus on cases, particular cases, or on class, ¿cómo se dice? Transversales? Cross-cutting issues like women, children, people with disabilities, etc. So we made reports each year once or twice about some particular issues to show the situations and afterward to help other institutions. Since a year ago, a commission of the civil society works very hard with the Constitutional Court in order to give to the Constitutional Court more elements to follow up the budget of the government for the IDPs and to follow up the law for the IDPs in Colombia. We made a report 2 or 3 months ago, which was very, very important. For the first time in the history, the Constitutional Court, at the same time, they listened to the national government and the civil society. Two reports, the same day and the same audience. That was very, very important. And we gave our report to the Constitutional Court. The government says the statistics, etc., and we said, well, we recognize the government had some improvements, but we want to stress in the very, very particular and very important issues. For example, the issue of employment. Most of the people are living in homeless, no employment. Housing, health for children. And we focus very well because we have before a national inquest, how is it?
Survey.
A national survey about the situation of the IDPs. So this is our work, and we work very hard with the communities in the regions. Many people in the rural areas and in the regions where the people have been threatened or they have to flee their region, their lands, to quit everything. They look for protection in the parishes and in the different churches, but in particular in the Catholic Church. So we work very hard with the diocese and the people in the rural areas to try to support their work with the internally displaced people and to give them more knowledge and more abilities to work on that. On the other hand, after that, the name of that database is Ruth, is the name of that Bible lady. It's just to take the name of that day. That doesn't mean nothing. It means the name of Ruth, because the book of the Ruth in the Bible, which is a very nice story. Afterward, we took a decision to start another database in general for victims, and that is Tevere. That means witness, truth, and reconciliation. Witness, truth, and reconciliation. Tevere. We started that, I think, around 6 years ago, taking information in different regions where other institutions hadn't the possibility to go to to stay there and to have information from the people. It's not to take all the information of the victims, but to give that service for those who are very, very isolated and very far away from the other institutions, in particular from the government. And now we are trying to combine both databases, the database for victims and the database for the internally displaced people, because we are working very hard with other institutions to try to push the government to accept that all the internally displaced people are part of the universe of the victims in Colombia. Because at the beginning, the law for deportation, they didn't recognize the internally displaced as victims. they said that this is one situation, but victims, really victims, are those who have lost their relatives or something in particular, but not displaced. Well, this is a very, very complex situation that is related also to the truth and the integrity of the process. In Colombia, you have very, very strange things like that. Instead, try to avoid to give everybody something as reparation, to have a very reduced number of people for reparation. That is at the end idea, because they feel they don't have money, or they don't are able to take the money of the perpetrators, which is a very, very huge amount of money. And we're working very hard with the victims in general. I want to stress, to show just one program. In some regions, we are trying to work with the local communities to give them more opportunities, more knowledge about how to accept and how to integrate those coming from other regions because they feel threatened. Because at the beginning, the people think, well, these are dangerous, they are threatened, then they are dangerous also for us. We don't want to integrate with them. So it's to try to push the people to integrate more and to be more open to those suffering coming from other regions.
Thank you.
Okay, in relation with the question, the relation between violations and human and civil society mobilization, well, it's huge. So I start maybe 10, 12 years ago to build a database on collective action for peace. I was a bit tired with counting dead people, in the sense that it was a lot of massacres, political assassination, and I said, well, what is happening in the Colombian society? Something good or something for peace has been done. And I start to build this, and the result of this is, well, that book, and we now have in CINEP, in the Center for Research and Popular Education, a database on collective action for peace. And what we have found is that in the last 25 years, at least 65 million people have mobilized for peace in Colombia. This is a cumulative figure, but this, in all this year, is really a huge mobilization for peace. Probably the largest in the world, in a country with violence, with current violence. Nevertheless, and I feel something that is connected with the situation is that not always this mobilization had the impact we are looking for, had the results of stopping the war. And this keep being a challenge for the peace organizations and for the all the people that are working in this. To show something, you will find here, this is the evolution. This blue one is all the level of a collective action for peace. And you can see that it was a growing level until 1997. And during the Pastrana government, that was the negotiation with FARC in Kawan, something that is critical is all the peace mobilization went down. Why? Say, because people start to feel that the government was doing the peace agreement. And this has an effect, and then it start to grow again in during Uribe period. Well, I think that not always we have time to find the connection between the peace mobilization and the way to have an incidence in the public policies, and especially in security policies and in peace policies. And I feel that something, for me, the main challenge for the church, for the social organizations, for the civil society organizations, is how to extend this link between what people is doing that really is huge, especially in the regions. We are witness that there are many peace initiatives in all the regions, and people trying to do something. For me, this is really a source of a hope, because doesn't matter the difficulty and the complexity of the region, you find people able to do something. And probably myself in the same situation, I won't do anything, because I will be really with fear of doing something. And the common people, especially women, and this is something that we need to stress, are able to do and to build something. It's incredible the way in which in some regions women are working for peace and reconciliation. And in part because they are victims. Many of their husbands have been killed, or the sons have been killed, and they start to play a very interesting role, trying to find not only the truth, but trying to rebuild a relationship and a connection in these regions. And you will find really something incredible in some of the experience. Women that tell you, well, I have found that something different is possible to do here. And in the group, trying to build, to share what that had happened. And women that had suffered here a lot, and they say, well, but we need to look to hope. And sometimes, without any feeling of revenge, I have heard from some women that have told me, say, I don't want that they suffer the same that I have suffered. What I want is a new, different society, a new, different context, and that we and they can live together. And this is something that really impacted me in the sense that if it's possible to build peace in Colombia, it's because people in the grassroots level is really looking for this in that context.
Thank you. Let's turn to our first questioner. If you could please identify yourself and your institution.
Absolutely. My name is Sharifa Pastori. I'm the Colombia Program Officer for CHF International. I want to say a big thank you for these very interesting firsthand accounts. When you alluded to the fact that obviously the demobilization process is challenging, to say the least, my feeling is, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that we have yet to see a recognition by the government that this process is somewhat that challenging and failing in some respects, because they're not able to assure the social and economic, especially reinsertion of these ex-combatants fast enough. And so what's happening is, because a lot of these demobilized people are not able to make a sustainable licit living, they're turning again to rearming. Do you think there will be some sort of recognition by the government, or if there has been, and do you see their approach changing as a result in the next year or two? I mean, the ACR clearly, I mean, I've spoken to a number of demobilized, we have a program to help demobilized people in Colombia, Montería, Valledupar. A number of them that I've spoken to have said, we've received the psychosocial support that we need, but we're not able to have our business plans approved by the ACR fast enough, and so we really have no choice. Well, how do you view the situation? And do you think it'll change, that the government will try to change their stance on that, or?
Well, I don't want to be skeptical.
Okay.
But I do. In the sense that there are two ambiguities.
Mm-hmm.
One is connected that obviously there is a problem of how you reintegrate people that have demobilized. And if you don't offer them a possibilities, well, what they know, they what they know is to use an ad and to do this. Mm-hmm. And this is a in some way a critical point. The problem is, what I say in connection, is really all the demobilization true? And this is for me a problem for the government. The government is saying, well, the paramilitary, there are no more paramilitary mm-hmm. groups. Mm-hmm. This finish is an old issue. Mm-hmm. And but to be honest, we don't agree with this. Mm-hmm. It's not a problem of new groups. The connection between the new, they call new groups, and the old groups, for us in some regions, are very, very strong. And also the connection with drug trafficking and other things. And in this sense, well, to read something, this is a quotation from Salvatore Mancuso, mm-hmm. one of the paramilitary yeah. chiefs. He said, "The realm of paramilitary groups is a reality, and we cannot minimize that. Also, the paramilitary groups that didn't negotiate are growing. There are new armed groups, as there had been before, and they are significantly increasing." What he says, all the three possibilities are growing. And this is one of the reasons. And he's saying, well, this is an ongoing phenomenon. And I feel, I think that this is true. But this is one point. The second point for me is the problem that the government is asking funds for the reintegration of the paramilitaries. And the consequence of this is that the victims is not receiving enough support. And for me, this is a quite a paradox. Because you can end supporting the perpetrators and not the victims. And obviously, to find the right balance between how to find support for the perpetrators, in the sense that if you want to reintegrate them, well, you need to do something. But how not to finish doing something, only something for the perpetrators and not for the victims. And for me this is a real challenge because I feel that there is larger the support for the perpetrators in this moment than for the victims in the international community. And this, given the policy of the government and given the question that the government is asking in connection with this.
Well, I agree with Father Maurizio. I want to say just something very, very quickly. The first one is the situation was not the same in all the regions of Colombia. You had different positions in the regions of Colombia regarding the mobilized people. In some regions, they had a plan. In other regions, they just wanted to the national government doing something for the reintegrated people in their regions. That makes a lot of difference also. The second one is that at the beginning there were not a clear strategy for the reintegration. It took a lot of time to have a plan. And still today, I think there is not a real strategy, a complex strategy for a so complex problem like this one. Third, I think the political will of the leaders of the paramilitaries is not clear. Some of them they negotiating because they were afraid of the extradition to the United States, some of them because they are business, other reasons, but they were not a real political will among all of them, and the same will was not clear. They had the same will. That there were a lot of groups fighting among them during the negotiation, and that made very, very complex. And the people on the basis and the grassroots level of the paramilitaries, they were not aware of the negotiation and the implications about the meaning of the mobilization. So at the end, they was demobilized by their bosses, but they was not involved in the process. They were not a real process among the people. That made so complicated the situation today, because they don't wanted the negotiation at the end. They was not involved in the process. And the last problem I can stress is the local communities receiving the mobilized people. So in a very small community, I know very small community in the north of Colombia, 400 people more or less, they received 500 ex-combatants. That was, for the people, incredible. And the situation was very hard because they received money, as Father Mauricio said, and there was nothing for the community, just for the ex-combatants. The message for the people was very, very difficult to understand. And the people, at the end, they finished to reject the our presence there. So for the future, it's very important to learn that working with the local community is very, very important. It's probably most important than working with them as individuals. But it's important to work with the community. Otherwise, the integration is not possible.
Thank you. Thank you. First of all, thank you very much for being here. My name is Mary Rodriguez. I am with the Institute of Conflict Analysis and Resolution. And it seems to me that all that you have talked about, also it's really tied to the definition of victim and victimhood itself. In some accounts that I have heard from paramilitaries, for example, it is like, I am this because of another thing that made me a paramilitary. You know, there was a guerrilla thing that made me this person that I became. And then there is people in the big cities that feel that they have been victimized, you know, for the armed conflict. And so in that sense, understanding how can you reconcile and how can you speak about truth with, you know, you have to define what parameters or what is a victim and how do you understand your own victimhood in a country that has, you know, we all have been hurt somehow. But is that victimhood? So I would like to hear a little bit more about your ideas and your concept of victim and victimhood. And what a victim is entitled to somehow.
Yeah, I agree. I think that the one critical point is how to break the cycle of violence, of collective violence that we have in the country. People that have been victims, and then they become a perpetrator. And this is an ongoing process from the 50s in the country. You can find that some of the guerrilla leaders were victims in the 50s, like Marulanda, and then others were victims in the 70s or 80s. But you find the same with the paramilitary groups, and not only with the paramilitary groups. You find this, for example, with the president of Colombia. His dad was kidnapped and killed by FARC. And this makes sometimes, I have sometimes question, well, is the president enough free for leading a policy for peace? And sometimes I have some doubts in relation to this. And for me, the point is how to break this and to start a process, a real process of reconciliation among all, because I feel there are, when you have this in mind, near 4 million people displaced, more than 90,000 people that had been killed or had died in the conflict, more than near 40,000 people kidnapped. And behind all these victims, all these people, their families and all, this is a really strong situation. And I feel, for me, one of the real challenges for the church is how to work in reconciliation. But not in an easy reconciliation. Because sometimes, well, the solution is we need to sit together both sides, probably in a moment, but you need to put conditions for this reconciliation can be possible. And for me, this is something that we need to work quite deep if we want to find a solution. Because unless we can break this cycle of violence, we are going to have a next generation of paramilitary groups, a new generation of guerrilla groups, and we will keep in armed conflict for forever. And we need to do something really strong there. And sometimes I don't know if we have enough clarity in relation to this. And this, I feel for myself and for what we are doing in our social center, the challenge is this: how to think and to plan and to develop strategies in that sense.
I think that is a very important question. According to the law, you have a definition of the victims in Colombia, and the international law has also clear definition on that. But the problem is, when you are working at the grassroots level in a society with communities, you have to deal with a political and ideological issue, which is the definition of victims. This is not just a technical problem. This is a political problem. This is an ideological problem. And that is the question. Because at the end, the people don't feel comfortable with the law. That is probably, that doesn't mean nothing for the people. But the people have their lecture of the victims, or the definition of the victims. It's impossible to solve here your question, but I think it's important to understand that in Colombia, in behind the underground, you have the question of the victims and the definition of the victims. I want to just to say an example. Today, the government are trying to distinguish between internally displaced people and victims of the displacement. It's difficult to understand. That is one of the problems. For example, if the law says if you are displaced, simple displaced, you have no right to reparation. If you are victim of displacement, you will have. What is the difference? I mean, you start to walk on the edge of the question. I think this is a very, very difficult. It's a very sensitive issue, because political and ideologically, this is a very, very key issue for reconciliation. And we must deal with that, and we must reflect on that. That from there depends the possibility that for the people to open and to reconcile.
Thank you. My name is Ann-Charlotte Nilsson, and I'm an independent researcher from Sweden. And thank you so much for your wonderful presentations. I have first one comment also, like on the to tell the truth in the midst of conflict and how dangerous it is, because I went to a seminar Friday, and they said regarding Colombia and the victims that have come forward in the national process of the justice and peace law, and like there are like 15 people that have been murdered of the victims that come forward. There are many people that have been threatened, and also people that marched, like on March 6th. I'd love to see it, that they have also been threatened. And I don't know, you know, how that it's so dangerous, how it impacts people to come forward. And maybe you could talk about that. And also, I have a second question, and that is regarding children and the work of Pastoral Social regarding children and youth. And that you have very many different programs from children and youth. And like some is how to teach youth how to deal with a conflict, and then also how to resist violence, and how do you do that? How do you work with that?
In the fact, obviously, there are risks in this moment to work in these issues, and the problem is that sometimes it could be a crazy dynamic in this sense. This is some of the emails that went through 10 days ago or 2 weeks ago. And it's are connected with the, it's supposed the new paramilitary groups, and they call that they are in a process of rearmament. And this is very clear. And they are going to attack all organizations, media, NGOs, embassies, Congress people, and the people in general that can collaborate with the narco guerrilla. And I will say, well, and many people receive this. I'm sorry that you say, well, it's difficult to understand that they are included in the list. For example, to say, the Fundación Ideas para la Paz, the Foundation of Ideas for Peace, that this is a business organization supported by businessmen. And they are included here. We also are included here. But also a journal like Semana, that is the most important or the most well-known journal in Colombia, a weekly journal. And they are there only because they have done some important reports on the whole situation. And I feel that it's necessary to ponder how you can manage this and how it's important to listen to this. But I feel that this can be a new situation. And for me, the most difficult point in connection with this is that the government is saying that that the paramilitary government is gone. And I feel that it's not. And it's necessary to be aware of this and how to face this critical situation. Because in this moment, all appear that the unique problem is FARC. And, well, they are part of the problem. But it's not the only problem. And in some cases, it's not the most critical problem. And it's necessary to face this. And obviously, I feel the international support in connection with this will be very important, because it's something that is critical in the situation. For example, some of the judicial cases in connection with human rights violations had been done in the country, given the pressure of the United States. In some way, the pressure that many of your organizations had done here had been effective in order to try to resolve some of the cases with trade unionists, with people, different organizations, NGOs, and so on. And I feel that this will be more important in the future. And please keep helping us in this sense.
And also the documentation that you're doing is becoming even more important.
Yeah.
Regarding pastoral social and what we are doing with children and just people, we face different problems. The first one is the forced recruitment for the guerrillas and by the paramilitaries and different groups in the rural areas and even in the cities. Today, we have the information that many people leave the regions because they try to avoid the forced recruitment of their children. Mm-hmm. When they saw their children growing, they started to feel that's danger for them, so they feel the regions, because the armed groups, they need more and more people for their armed activities. So that's one of the problems. The other one is the traffic of human beings. In Colombia, that is not very well known, but we have a very, very big problem in that sense. Many children have been stolen or in one way, or have been sold or something like that for the traffickers. And this is a risk also in the cities. On the other hand, you have a lot of violence within the families and in general in the society. A report last week showed that the violence within the schools in Bogota is at the same level like it is in Salvador. So it's a very, very high level of violence in the schools, many children have been threatened or stolen or injured at the school, during the school. So that means in the schools the situation is very difficult in Bogota, and that's the capital. You can imagine the rest of the country. Drugs around the school, lots of problems around. So the children are in a very, very difficult situation. And the last one is lack of good education, good level of education. So we are trying to do different things. We are trying to give them opportunities, and we try to work a lot in arts, sports, trying to give the opportunity to have small groups to reflect on peace and to engage the children in their neighborhoods, out of the school in many cases, in other cases in the schools, but out of the school it's very important to engage them in activities, to learn about the citizenship and to try to exercise their possibilities and to have some kind of organization in groups. We call that groups of interest groups. I mean, you like theater, you can have something on theater. If you like, for example, football, you can have something in football. And all of them around peace and this kind of issues. Last year we had a very interesting tournament in Bogota, in the south of Bogota, which is a very, very poor neighborhood, very poor area. We have different groups playing football for peace. It's different football, all around peace, all around respect, all around solidarity. That is small steps, but that's important. Yeah.
I'm Shira Zamir from American University. You mentioned the current Reconciliation and Reparations Commission that's going on in Colombia, and it seems to me like it's kind of limited and one-sided because the government isn't really acknowledging any of their guilt. It's just the paramilitaries coming forward. And then on the other hand, you talked about South Africa, which was an example of something that was very open and very public, and there were hearings on television, and there were several thousand people involved. And the opposite would be, say, Guatemala, which had also had a commission of historical clarification, but the government didn't really participate, and there were no public hearings. And everything was basically done on paper. So where do you see Colombia falling on that scale between sort of what Guatemala had and what South Africa had? And is it possible to have a really open commission while the conflict is still going on?
I'm just going to add one piece of that question to extend it a bit. If you see the National Commission on Reparation and Reconciliation as a precursor to a truth commission, or if it's seen as a truth commission operating under conflict?
Well, I think could be a previous step mm-hmm. of a really truth commission in the future. But I am not sure that the current commission will be able to develop all what is needed to do. I feel that they have done a interesting work. Two of our researchers are connected with the commission in a subcommission that are working in trying to build a story of the whole violence and the situation that we have faced in the country. And in this sense, I feel that probably it will be a lot of information that we are going to collect and we are going to have. But what for me is not clear is that we are going to resolve in this moment the point. To say, in the South African Commission was at the end of the process and was possible to go through the whole situation. The problem is, well, we are facing in this moment some of the paramilitary responsibilities. But what happened with the new paramilitaries, what happened with the guerrillas abuses, what happened with the army abuses? Because practically the topic of the armed forces has been developed in the commission. The focus has been in the paramilitaries, and you have there the other elements. And in this sense, I feel that has been interesting, and also with the peace and justice law and the process that the declaration of the paramilitaries in the process, we have known quite a lot of situations and quite a lot of abuses. Have been possible to discover many of the mass graves, and but it's not the final point. This is for me what is critical. You are going probably to finish with something quite ambiguous, in the sense that you will. What could you expect from a commission that is working in this moment when the guerrilla is still active, the paramilitaries are in the process of rearmament, to say something, and it is not clear the situation with them? You say, well, it's difficult to reach a final point that can be a starting point for a process of reconciliation. Because I feel that we need, in a moment, to know what happened in Colombia and what happened with all the armed actors, where all the abuses were committed in the government, and to know this and to present this in a very clear way, so to know what really went on with the guerrillas, with the paramilitaries, with them, and to have a really whole picture of the dynamic, and to take from that the points that are critical in order to build a process of reconciliation. And but for me, it's not clear that this will be possible in this moment. And in this sense, I feel that it will be a step, but only a step.
In my opinion, the current commission we have in Colombia have a lot of problems. In part because it's not really independent of the government. For example, today the risk is that the government gives to the commission the role to have something to do with the in the reparation process. In that, if the commission take that that role, the commission will be like the operator of the government, and that is the end of the independence of that commission. For a commission to have or to give a real results, to have success in terms of truth and other process in the reconciliation, is to be independent of the government. This commission, I can see a crisis coming in this commission, or a reform or something like that. The commission can go for a long term like it is today. Because that was the first step, as Mauricio said, but today it's very clear the problems, the lack of power, for example. Most people think, what this commission is useful for? What this commission is for? When they go to the regions in Colombia to visit the communities, the local communities, they have to hide that they are part of the commission. They say, well, we are an NGO, we are work with the international community, something like that. Otherwise, the people don't say nothing to them. There is not confidence in that commission at the local communities. That shows how difficult is their problem is, how the situation today. So they have to reveal the purposes of the commission or the goals. Or I don't know, but it's impossible to go ahead with that.
Well, I've been given the signal. I know that our guests have further meetings and they're running a little bit behind. But I'd like to thank you all for coming, and I'd like to thank our guests for their presentations and for the really important work that you're doing in Colombia. and we look forward to being in touch.
Thank you.